Thank you very much for attending this session. It's session 101, Managing Global Support, Core Competencies. My name is Christoph Recknagel, and first and foremost, I want to point out there are about 14 other very interesting sessions going on in parallel. So I appreciate that you're coming, but please also make sure that this is the session you want to be in, Global Support, okay? We'll talk about, or I hope you're here, because you're looking for some clues about how to manage, how to provide, how to run a global support operation. Now, if you are looking for lessons or techniques how to do miracles, that session 115, that's down the hallway. So we'll talk here about very basic stuff. It's not very complex. I will largely talk about what we are doing at the Boston Consulting Group, how we run our internal IT department. I'm not here to offer you consulting services. As a matter of fact, I'm not a consultant. I'm with IT, so don't worry. There's no danger. And we talk a little bit about how to lead virtual teams, how to run a distributed support organization, what it takes, what are the difficulties and the challenges, and that all of this is very much not rocket science. It's very much common sense. So if there's anything that I would like to convey during this 45 minutes plus questions, then that there's nothing more complicated about providing global support than there's anything complicated about providing local support or regional domestic support. The content of this session, so we talk about what we are doing at the Boston Consulting Group. I will in a minute give you a bit more details about our organization. We'll hear a little bit about our structure and our approach and how we changed our own organizational structure to better deal with the challenges of global support. We also talk a bit about how you maximize the impact of your support organization. Now, this is a very big statement. What it means for you, of course, depends very much on what you make out of it. The impact of your support organization very much depends on the impact of your people, right? So, and in managing a global team, it's very much about giving everyone in your team the right amount of attention and enable your people to perform. This is probably the one biggest challenge that we are facing. We'll also talk about ownership, motivation, commitment, how we capture business needs, and something that we try to really cultivate in our organization. It's think global and act local. And this is more or less the mantra that we have given ourselves for years and years and years, and it has triggered a lot of changes within our organization because we inherently feel that we can best serve our internal customers by really thinking and or acting local, but thinking with the global organization in mind. Okay. About the Boston Consulting Group, or maybe first and foremost about myself. I'm the IT service director, which means that I report to our CIO, and I have three fellow directors responsible for applications development, infrastructure, and security. And I started in 1997 as an IT support specialist. So I was fixing computers and running around doing sneaker network support. I became IT director in 2004. I had the pleasure to work not only in Germany, but also in the US, namely in Washington, D.C. and in Boston, in Australia, and I live now in the UK. So forgive me with my English accent. I hope you can deal with it. The, let's jump here a bit. The Boston Consulting Group has by now about 70 offices in about 38 countries. And we support today almost 6,000 users. Our locations vary. We have our largest offices with 400 people, total staff, and we have the smallest locations with about 10, 15 people. And anything in between is the user base that essentially me and my team has to support. Which also means that we have to deal with very different situations. I mean, on one side, we have very large offices, and we have large IT teams there. The help desk alone in our largest organization comprised of about 7 to 8 people. Then we have infrastructure people often on site. We have applications developers on site. And then we have the contract. So we have up to 25, 30 people in some of our major hubs, all IT staff. And then we have the contrast where one single guy is responsible for maybe his 50 or 60 users, and he has to cover all aspects of IT. And all these people, whether they work in larger teams or as kind of lonely soldiers out there in the trenches, they are in the IT service organization, which means that they all form a network of people responsible for keeping our notebooks, desktops, the software, our users up and running. And this is essentially what this presentation is also about this organization, what we do. It is not solely focused on help desk or call center. It is this service organization. And this is just the way we operate. This is very much all I know, so I can't talk about anything else. And you might have very different backgrounds. Now, what I would like to hear and understand from you are just a few keywords, kind of problems, questions, challenges that you have that brought you today, this morning, here into this room, other than that maybe all the other rooms were all already filled. So any thoughts? Kind of what brought you here? Okay, so projects that are starting or are executed on a local level with some global or regional impact. Okay, yeah? Global support in a decentralized IT organization. Yes, very good. Managing people you never see. Yes, very common problem. Yes. Any other thoughts, please? Okay. Combine local IT staff and the support center into one group. Yes? Okay, global sourcing, moving people around. Yes? Relocation? Okay, yeah, okay, good. It probably will not come up during the session, but I'm more than happy, and that's for all of you the case. Try to do my best to make myself available after the session. So if there's anything that we are not able to cover, I'm more than happy kind of to chat with you about it, because the same problems that you're facing are probably also the same problems that I'm facing. So at best, maybe we can stick our heads together, brainstorm a little bit, okay? How to support clients across time zones. Okay, yeah. Good, very good. Okay, so I get the sense that's roughly what I will talk about. Maybe not in every single detail, but I'm glad to hear that this is also what I had in mind when I had to sit down and put the slides together for this presentation, because global support can be everything, right? I mean, it can be the human factor, it can be the technology, it can be the tools, it can be the structure. Okay. Agenda. Just quickly. So we talk briefly about the global challenges. We then talk about the structure. Now again, that's the right structure for us. I'm pretty sure it will not be the right structure for you. But I want to tell you the story of how we changed our structure in an effort to provide better support. So we'll hear a little bit about how we are organized. We talk about authority and responsibility. That's a topic that comes up very often when I'm interacting with people all around the world, that they are frustrated or they just don't know who's responsible for what. We're talking about how to measure performance, also across locations and geographies. We talk a bit about communication, and part of communication is certainly all the aspects, email communication, oral communication, how you bring people together, what are our experiences with this, kind of what works, what doesn't work. Also, more than forward-looking to hear your experiences. Collaboration, what we do to enable collaboration between teams, especially between our distributed and virtual teams. And then a topic that is very near and dear to my heart, and those are cultural differences. And being German, having lived in the US for several years, also having seen Americans coming over to Europe, also people going to Asia, it's always very interesting kind of what kind of notions and what kind of situations, experiences people are going through. So what are today's global challenges? And why is global support so difficult? Now, I don't think that global support is difficult for much different reasons than domestic support is difficult and challenging. Priorities are often conflicting. Now, what plays into this on a global level is that reporting lines are often not very well defined, that you struggle with the shortcomings and the implications of a metrics organization. So sometimes you have to work with people and you don't have direct access. You cannot simply tell them what to do. And this is my experience, sometimes it's very nerve-wracking and frustrating. I mean, you know what needs to be done. You know the capacities, the people are there. You just can't make them doing it. And this is a challenge that we're facing often. I don't think it's certainly not the fault of the people, it's the fault of the managers, right? So we have to do our best to make them want doing it. Well, overload is certainly also a challenge, but not much different as a challenge than any regular sort of non-global organization. What is special to global support is certainly the communication problems. Now, you have to deal with people who are sitting on the other side of the earth, different time zones, they are non-native English speakers. Sometimes English can be very challenging. Sometimes, even if they do understand what you say, they still don't understand it the way you mean it. There's a lot of delay, right? I mean, if you have to deal with people in Australia or Asia somewhere and there's a 10-12 hour time difference, it's very difficult just to get stuff done, right? Just to get them on the phone. And then something that maybe in a local environment takes half an hour or so to get sorted out often then stretches over several days, right? And then you have this factor of remote communication, indirect communication, and all this really causes problems. So I'll talk a little bit about what we are doing here. And then, of course, cultural differences, trust issues are a problem. I would say even this is not much different than what you experience in a more local, centralized environment. It's just that the nature of global support often amplifies those problems, which means if you deal with people of different temperaments, of different personalities, if you do it on a local level, you have much more opportunities to sort those problems out. If you experience this on a global level with a couple of thousand miles between you and this person or the other person, then this is certainly much more different, much more difficult to understand and to appreciate kind of what is their background, right? Where are they coming from? What is their intention? So for us, a starting point was finding the right structure. Now with offices and locations all over the globe, with the exception of Africa, is challenging to understand and to come up with an approach that addresses all the issues. And most likely, there is no such solution. We started out as very local organizations, as a very local office organization, I should say, which means that every office had a very high degree of independence. Every office did their own IT stuff. They were buying, it was like 15 years ago, they were buying Macintosh computers, they were running their own networks. The only thing that was central was one central email system that we introduced. And that was it. Now, from there, we went through a few evolutionary steps, I should say. And depending on where you are in your organization, depending on where your organization is structure-wise, in some cases, you might be able to influence this. In some cases, you just have to live with what you've been given, right? So I understand, of course, that, I mean, it's maybe easy to say, well, yeah, change your structure, but hell, how can I change our structure? Well, even if you're not in the position of changing the structure yourself, but maybe you can spark a thought process about what is the right structure for us to support and provide global support. So this is how the structure, how our structure looked like in the years 1998 till 2003. It's a very regional-oriented structure. You see, we have an Americas IT director, a European IT director, and an Asia-Pacific IT director. And then in those geographies, it's largely regional staff. We have a service group, an infrastructure group, and an applications group. So we have almost mini versions of our global IT organization in every region, which gives us a lot of flexibility, and we were able to react very fast to whatever local requirements we encountered or we had to meet, which means that if the IT director in Europe saw a problem, then he could decide right then and there. And he didn't have to ask anyone, well, I mean, within reason, for permission, he could just act. Now, it also means that after a while, of course, the IT infrastructure in the Americas and in Europe and Asia Pacific looked somewhat different, right? I mean, it's natural if you have three different individuals setting the direction for an organization, then you end up in three different places. And even though conceptually, we were all on the same page. And of course, you had meetings and you were working together and you were trying kind of to bring everybody on board and make everybody move. I mean, certainly specifically our CIO, make everybody moving into the right directions. But the same fact that creates an advantage, that is making local decisions, at the same time also creates huge problems because then you have to live with local decisions. So I'm not saying that this structure is particularly bad, but for us, after we went through this period of learning, it has proven as not the optimal structure. So we took what we learned in this structure and we thought about it. Well, let's just not put it upside down, but make it lean to the side, which means instead of having global regional groups, and then within each region, kind of then application, service, infrastructure, and so forth, we created global functional teams. So we have infrastructure, applications development, and service under the leadership of one director. So we took away the regional directors, and we established those functional teams. Now, of course, it's a zero-sum game, right? So whatever you win on one end, you lose on the other side, right? I mean, there is no optimal structure, but there is a structure that maybe accommodate more your needs. And to explain what I mean by that is, of course, before we had silos within the regions. So the Americas were doing what they wanted, the Europeans were doing what they wanted, and the Asians were just following, and they were actually smart. They were waiting and watching to see what works out best, and then they adopted this. So that was actually a very, very smart approach. Now, the same silos that we may have created within geographies, today we have to we're struggling with having these silos more on the functional dimensions, right? So that the service people don't talk as often with the infrastructure people, and the infrastructure people don't talk often enough with the applications people, and so forth. I'm sure that's also a very common problem. And this has a lot to do with affiliation, right? I mean, whatever affiliation you offer your people, whatever the tribe, and we will come back to this later on, whatever group or family you offer your people, that's essentially the structure then you have to work with. So we changed the group and the family, right? Before, I was part of, let's say, the European family, and that was my team. Now, all of a sudden, they took this away, and now I'm part of a different tribe. Now I'm part of the service team. I'm now this member on a global level, right? And we bring these people together often, and we make sure that they network with each other. But it's just a different cut. And this is something you have to keep in mind when you think about your structure. Depending on what kind of frustrations you're going through and you're experiencing today, they're certainly not the magic bullet, so to speak, that solves all your problems. But for us, this structure, this global structure, functional alignment, has proven as, I would say, much more effective and efficient than the structure we had before. Now, maybe what also contributes to this is the fact that we went through the learning and through the experience, and many people, actually, all of the people that we took into the new structure, of course, also had the experience of the previous structure. Now, I want to talk a bit about the service delivery model that we are using, which is a fairly big word, or something rather simple, and that's our support structure. What you see here are the three major sort of elements or ways of how you can provide a certain service. So we can provide a service either on a local level, we can provide it through our service centers, or we can provide it to third parties, external companies, partners, and so forth. And what we provide on these different levels are different services. For instance, the help desk is provided solely from our service centers. Extended hour support as well, and in some cases, from external partners. The local support is solely provided by our local teams. Training is provided jointly, in some cases from local teams, and in some cases from our service centers. And then we have this big piece, what we call group technology internally, or at the time called it this way. So that's third level support, innovation, and projects. So that's from our perspective. If we look at IT, then we have on one side all our operational responsibilities. So that's basically keep the lights on, right, and making sure that IT is working and functional. And on the other side, we have everything that has to do with change, projects, innovation, sitting down, doing some R&D, testing out whatever the latest Microsoft products, working with our users, customers, making sure that we know about their needs and the right solutions. And while we had this ambitious goal, that we could also centralize these activities into the service centers, and instead of just having call centers, we would have what we refer to as resource centers. And I would say, in terms of experience and in terms of how successful we were with this approach, we brainstormed this in 2004. Then we very quickly implemented the first level support and centralized this, and we are running this now on a global basis. We struggled somewhat with adding anything other than first-level support to those service centers. It might be a problem how we deal with change. It's also, for us, a big problem how we value our experts, because moving a lot of know-how, meaning moving a lot of people into those centers, often also requires physical relocation of people. And that's a big problem, and so we had to learn that, well, at a blank table, you can brainstorm all these great ideas, and you can say, well, of course, yeah, and then we put the people here, and we make them move there, and this all works out great, right? And then you leave the room and you meet the people, and they say, well, what are you thinking, right? I have a wife, I have kids, my partner is working here, so I'm not relocating. So that's certainly a problem. I'm sure you also if you manage people then, and you have to deal with global support, then relocation is probably worth a presentation of its own. So because of that, we're not as far with implementing this comprehensive central model where we not only provide first level but also third level and project work from a central location. That's the workflow. So we have the users, certainly the center of our attention. They're supposed to call our help desk, our centralized service centers, and then they more or less dispatch, if needed, to the local support teams. And I'm sure that's pretty standard and I assume pretty consistent with what you guys are doing, because that's just the way you run IT, right? You have first level, second, third level. What was interesting for us also was to identify channels for taking in new employees and new staff and to develop people. And I have to say, just to share a bit of real life experience here, when we introduced this model in 2004, we were very optimistic that establishing the first level support centers would really open a never-ending pool of talent for second and third level. Well, it has proven that this is not exactly the case. Because people who enjoy working in first level support positions are not always the kind of people that also desire to work on projects, working very irregular hours, working at times with a lot of travel, working with international teams. So, we still, I mean, from time to time, we have people moving into the help desk positions and then moving up kind of into second or third level positions, but it's more the exception. So there is no continuous career development, if you will. And that's largely because we experience that the kind of people who join the first level support and the kind of people who are really good at the first level support positions are not necessarily the kind of people that we later also have in second or third level support positions. So I already mentioned a number of times the terms first level, second, and third level. So here's just another overview of our structure. So we have the service centers providing the first level support. So that's the first point of contact for all IT requests. Well, it's supposed to be the first contact for all sort of IT requests, and I'm not sure what your experience is, if you have a centralized support. And at the same time, also technicians locally on site. We went through this transition over 3 years, and we still have users, customers, who prefer just to walk downstairs, knock at people's door, and have their problem fixed right then and there. How many of you, I see a couple of people nodding, how many people have this kind of situation? That you have a central support, but still people approach you at your local desks? Okay, yeah, that's a good number, so about 20%. We found that this is a very big challenge and very difficult to break with. Essentially, we didn't want to force people into using the phone. So we didn't want to tell people, well, sorry, if you don't have a ticket number, I can't help you. It was a conscious decision on our part that we didn't want this kind of situation. Because we also feel, I mean, our consultants, our users and customers, they're very highly paid people. They're very expensive. If they feel their problem is better being taken care of by walking down to see Joe to have their hard disk replaced or something, then we want to provide them this opportunity. Nevertheless, the service centers achieve over the couple of months, they exceeded the service levels that we have defined. So they regularly beat the 80% mark that we have set for the first call resolution, which means that 80% of the people who call the service centers globally really are being helped. And 80% is, I think the industry standard is somewhere between 60-70%. it's for us a great result. And I blame largely our external partner. We're working with tech team. They're providing all our global service center operations. I largely blame their excellence, and I'm not getting paid by tech team, but if you're considering kind of outsourcing this or partnering with a company, we have made very good, overall very good experience with them as a partner. Now, of course, you go through ups and downs, and there are also things that don't work that great, but then they are always able to work them out. And I'm pretty sure that introducing this concept for us, without the help of a professional company that specialized in providing first-level support, that is in command of all the processes, that is skilled in making these things work, we would have failed. Because if we would have done it ourselves, we naively, I mean, we get a lot of things done on a best effort basis. And we have very committed people. But if you're not an expert in this particular subject and you really want to drive efficiency, then really the best that could happen to us was to find the right partner. And we felt that our tech team, in terms of size, in terms of their culture, in terms of the people we're working with, are really a good fit for us. Doesn't mean that they're necessarily a good fit for everyone, but I mean, we found that we're very lucky. So then we have local IT. So that's pretty much the people on the ground. Second level support, they often also have, well, not they often, they do have the problem ownership for everything that comes over from first level support. So everything that gets escalated, if you will, the buck stops with them. They are responsible for the service delivery and the service quality in our offices. So our people on the ground are essential for us and in our model because they bridge the gap between our experts, especially when a problem is of more complex nature and needs to get escalated, and the users. So they stay on the ball, right? They continue to own the problem. They have a high degree of ownership. And it was the same high degree of ownership that made it for us very, very difficult to introduce a centralized first-level support. That's the same kind of ownership that we want them to have. And that allows us to really be brilliant as an organization because every one of them really feels the pain when something goes wrong. There's a question. Everything that comes through, so everything that gets escalated from the first level, essentially that sits and it stays with our second level support people, our local people who are in our offices, in our locations, who know the users, who know the customers, who are often then the link between our, let's say, the technical back end of our organization and the customers. Then we have another group called shared staff, that's third level support. Now we started out with shared capacity, so people in local offices were also working in this expert capacity. We figured out that after a while, this doesn't work out greatly, because if you are torn between operational responsibility and project work, something has to give. So we moved to 100% responsibility, so that people who are becoming experts, who are kind of on an expert track, whatever, Exchange experts, Outlook experts, Microsoft Office experts, the people who are responsible for our client image, they're now 100% dedicated, and they're not shared between support, any support function and their primary responsibility. And last but not least, we have management. Okay. So what we found important, and that's the summary just for this section, it's not yet the summary for the session, so please stay. It's important to eliminate the geographic boundaries that you have in your head. We found that a lot of these boundaries exist in people's heads. When they tell us, well, I cannot work with these people because they are not within my team, or they don't talk with me or so, then it's often just a vision or a picture that people have in their heads. There is nothing in terms of structure that prevents them from working with each other. And we had to spend a lot of energy, a lot of travel expenses on working this out and bringing people together. The only thing that really worked for us was really allowing people to spend time together and to work together in close proximity. Creating teams with global leadership, that was essential for us, because without the global leadership, you just don't have global teams. So that's fairly simple. Centralization forces consistency. Once you have global leadership, you are in a much better position to identify the elements in your organization, the services that you want to centralize. This is a phase where we are currently in, and we really try to identify now tasks that we perform in every single office or in every region that can be centralized, that can be put under someone's control, so that we then can think about optimization. So for us, centralization is a first step, and then optimization is a second step. It doesn't always mean outsourcing and getting, like, say, laying off people. It's for us, because we are a growing organization, we grow on an annual basis by about 12 to 15%. For us, it's a necessity, because we are being challenged to keep IT headcount flat, and I'm sure it's much the same everywhere, right? So every year, every day, we struggle with the challenge of getting more stuff done with the same amount of people, or same number of people. And for us, this centralization and then driving efficiency through a process, that's really where we have a lot of hopes into. Participatory leadership style, for sure, if you make people part of the solution, they are much more engaged and they're much more willing to work with you. We found this in the introduction of our central support. Until we really had the buy-in of our local people, this wasn't working. And wherever we went, every single office that we visited, we made it really a priority to convince our local people that this is in their best interest to have a central support center helping them. It's not threatening their jobs, and we come to this point at the very end again. If it's a threat to them, of course, they cannot embrace the idea, and they cannot send their users to call the service center or to call any kind of central institutions that you want them to refer their users to. Okay. Next topic, briefly, but authority and responsibility. Well, authority and responsibility is also very, very complex subject, but for us it comes down to who's in charge of what and how can I find out about it. That's the number one question in our organization. When people work together in teams, especially in a global distributed organization, the question of who can I ask or who can help me with something, that's the number one problem for us. Years before team size, years before, I would say, Web 2.0 technologies, it was more that the people were complaining that they don't have access to technology, access to information. Nowadays, our number one complaint is that they can't find it because there's so much stuff out there. And so this is also something that we put a lot of effort into, trying to make it clear who's in charge of what, and we found that a service catalog is helpful. Just to list out, okay, what are the things we do, and who are the people in charge of these? And in what kind of capacities is, let's say, Joe involved with the email system? Or if you have a problem and you need to provide a certain piece of software, who can you ask? Well, the service catalog for us is a central repository, and I would recommend, if you think about global support and if you feel that you don't have enough structure in your organization, look for presentations that address the service catalog issue during this conference. For us, it was really an eye-opening experience once we figured out how essential a service catalog can be to structure and to organize IT. Well, teams often maintain internal networks, which means they do trade information almost as a currency. And this is also something we didn't necessarily want to break with, but we recognize this, that, I mean, everybody loves to share information. because it makes me look good, because I'm in the know, right? I'm aware of things, and I can share it with you, right? So the next time you know something, you will also share it with me. And that's an effect that I would say is very dominant within our organization, that people trade information really with each other. So on one side, it means that you cannot devaluate this currency. If you make everything totally available, right, then people also don't have anything more to share. But what worked really well for us is almost to, in a viral fashion, kind of to plant information within our teams. So not to give everything out to everybody, because that's spamming everybody anyway, but to really seed information strategically. For instance, we have started now a wiki website about office build-outs and renovation projects and office moves, where people share their information. And we didn't send it out to the whole team, telling them, well, there's this website, and you can go to this, and you can find information, you can share information. But we just told a few key individuals, namely the people who are involved in these things and who are looking into a build-out or looking into an office move. And they now take this information and they seed it within our organization. So they now make sure that this also information find its way to other people. And we found that this is actually working not too bad. Well, at the very end, you also need some sort of common information sharing, so that you make information in general accessible to everyone. But also this viral approach works quite well. Measuring performance is another aspect of our organization that is very important to us. Now, we are very proud that in our annual IT survey, we have a response rate of more than 50%. And we try to keep it that high. I think the average on these things is somewhere in the 25 to 40% range. And what you see here is essentially kind of across all our locations, kind of the feedback rate. And you see that, well, in some cases it's somewhere in the 30% range, but the majority of offices really is above, or a good portion of all our locations are above the 50% feedback range. In some cases, the smaller offices even reach 100%. It's important to us because we want to know how we are doing on a frequent basis, and we want to know it from as many people as possible, certainly on a global level. We also found that there are not much differences. Here you see the different regions. I just had to take out the names. Here you see the worldwide summary on a scale from 1 to 5, where 1 is excellent, 2 is good, 3 is average, 4 is poor, and 5 is forgot about it because we never use it. Over the past years, starting in 2004, we had a bit of a bump there, but we gradually improved in almost all our systems, and in some cases we didn't. But it is important for us not only to capture the quantitative feedback, but also the qualitative feedback in form of comments. So we try to select quotes from our customers, from those surveys. We read every single comment. We share the feedback we receive with our local teams, and the response and the reaction to this feedback is on a global level very consistent, which means that there are also no differences in how people react to feedback. So when we collect it on a global level and we share it out then with the local teams, again, following this think global, act local, they really take it. They also take it as quite valuable information to understand and to see how do they compare with other offices. Now, having a large number of locations for us certainly creates a very fortunate situation that we can benchmark locations against each other. And we use this also to tell offices, well, how did they do last year compared with last year with the previous year's results? And in some cases, we have offices that improved, and in some offices, we have In some cases, we have offices that declined, of course, and it's interchangeable, right? And some offices decline 1 year, and then they improve the next year. I mean, that's the goal. Overall, we want to make sure that all offices somehow end up in this area here. And it's very helpful for discussions to show offices and to show our locations and our local managers how they compare with other locations, because then they understand that it's doable. It's doable to achieve a good to excellent rating in an office of their size, because there are five or six other offices in the same situation. So measuring performance, to summarize this, for us it's important that we frequently measure this, and it's also important that we test the survey. I would say these two things: do it frequently, or do it regularly, I should better say, and test it before you send it out. We had quite a decline in response rates 2 years ago because we didn't test it properly enough, and we asked simply too many questions. We asked a very dumb question. We figured out in retrospect, where we asked people, well, how often do you restart your machine? And then we gave them different answers. We wanted to know about it because we went through a period where our client image was very unstable. We had a lot of issues with drivers and stability, and so there were a lot of complaints. So we wanted to know about how stable is it really. And the question was pretty clear for us from the IT side. Well, it was not pretty clear from the user side, because what does it mean? Do you mean how often I shut it off and switch it on? Do you mean how often I have to reboot it? Or do you mean how often I get a blue screen? And this is, I would say, an indirect implication of running a global organization, because then something that's very clear to a native speaker is not clear at all to a non-native speaker. And then on top of these syntactical problems, you have semantical problems, because an IT person might understand this question much different than a non-IT person. So you have the language barrier, and then you have the barrier just to understand the question. So this is something that's very important, and that we found very important for us, is to measure, but also to test. Communication, well, it's quite easy to do this top-down, right? Memos, emails distributed to your teams. It's very difficult to capture information back, right? So the one-to-many communication works rather easy. The many-to-one information communication is rather a challenge. Well, of course, we use emails, but we also try from time to time some bit more progressive, innovative ways of communicating. We tried podcasts, we tried videos, we certainly try just bringing people together in groups. And I would say if there's anything, any takeaway out of the communication section in this presentation, is then there's also here not one single silver bullet and one size kind of fits all solution. So you have to do a little bit of everything. The one thing that we found is important on the communication side is that if you just send out an email, nobody will hear your message. If you just do a presentation, nobody will hear your message. You have to tell them again, and tell them what you told them. If you have to do it repetitively, and you have to do it again and again and again if it's a really important topic. If it's not important, well, then do just one memo or do just one presentation, and then you're done with it, right? And then you feel you have done your share telling people about it, about the news, about the change, about the new product. But people don't feel that this was important to you, because if it would have been important to you, you would have spent more energy on communicating it properly to them. So this is also something that we took away, or that I took away as a learning experience, that communicating one thing just once, it's just like not saying anything at all. So you have to tell people again, and you have to communicate repetitively. You also have to give people some sort of identity. Well, we did it with logos and templates. Actually, when we moved into the new support structure, the first thing that our people asked for is, well, can we have a logo? And I was a bit surprised because I felt they had other problems than the logo, but it was very important to them because they wanted to feel a certain identity. And again, this was a request that did not come from one particular country, but it came from very different places of the world. But they all had an interest to participate in this new structure, and they all had the interest also to contribute. So there was a lot of development and innovation going on and participation amongst the teams. Well, mission statement, it's certainly good to be able to articulate what is it actually that we are doing in our organizations, right? What is our purpose? Maybe not in life, but at least in our business. And you see sometimes this kind of mission statements. It is our business to conveniently revolutionize long-term high-impact resources to allow us to seamlessly network enterprise-wide services. And then you wonder where they are coming from, and some actually come from the Dilbert mission statement website. So what I'm trying to depict here is you should have a mission statement, and you should make sure that everyone on a global level understands what you guys are doing. But you have to keep it simple. So these are all very negative examples of mission statements that say a lot, but they mean very little for the people, right? So you have to make sure that a mission statement is short, and you have to make sure that people can memorize it. Also the non-native speakers. And that they really can use it to identify themselves with your organization. That's something we also found is important for people to have something they can relate to. Collaboration. Outlook is still our collaboration tool number one, where people exchange information in emails and documents. SharePoint is something we have started now with. And this is actually a very interesting experiment for us, where we allow people more to be in control. We try to give people full author rights to those websites, and we figured that they embrace it actually much more when they can design their own website, their own little MySpace page. They are much more receptive for this than if we tell them, please go there and post your documents. Nobody went there and posted their documents. But when they figured out that they could do their own little website, they all went, and they all did something. And then all of a sudden, you find some really cool solutions. And it's still public, but for some reason, they feel a little bit easier about doing it kind of on their own side. And again, it's still a public website within our corporate intranet, and it's accessible to everyone. It's just a different starting point. Instead of telling them, well, here's our huge corporate portal, dump your information here, we're telling them, well, here's a tool, you can play with it. And that's what they did. Cultural differences. Something that's very interesting and often underestimated is the attention span in different cultures. Now, while I'm still fresh and bright here, you guys already might struggle with the oxygen supply in this room. And this has to do that Germans or Northern Europeans have an attention span of roughly 1 hour. So I can talk for 1 hour, and you can talk to me for 1 hour, and, well, maybe I get bored, but I certainly don't get tired. North Americans typically, and this is no offense, this is just a fact, after 45 minutes, so I guess my time is up, after... Yes, no problem. Asians have an even shorter attention span. And so when you schedule a two-hour marathon conference call to discuss some important matters, then nobody will listen to it. And then I guess we can't be surprised that people do their email in the background, and then they don't listen, and they have their phones on mute. Actually, putting phones on mute during conference calls is the worst thing you can do. If I can leave you, let you go out of this room with one thing you should keep in mind, never, ever put your telephone on mute when you're attending a conference call. Never, ever. Because the moment you put your phone on mute, the next thing is you check your email. Okay? And so does everybody else. Okay. Well, tell stories. It's something that I've... Oh, sorry, there's a question. Well, I grabbed this one from another presentation we had in-house. I think the internet certainly is very rich. I couldn't point you to one specific resource. But if you Google just attention span, you'll already find some interesting results. Yes, yes. But then the next question then would be, well, is that then really the best working environment for them, right? I understand. And sometimes, of course, you have these situations. You're on the train, right? You can't do it. And then the choice is either I miss this call or I put my phone on mute. But then, of course. But it shouldn't be the rule. It should be the exception. And since I followed this advice, well okay, it takes me a little bit longer to respond to an email, but I participate more, and I feel also everybody I told about this participates more. So one small takeaway. Cross-cultural encounters, something that we found is true, whether people joining a global team or whether people joining an exchange program and they are being shipped from, let's say, the US to Europe or from Europe to the US or to Asia. There's a certain period of enthusiasm followed rather quickly by a period of frustration. And then at some point in time, recovery starts, and then people start to appreciate, and then eventually people start again to perform. And we saw this, I saw it myself, when I moved from Germany to the US. In the first moment, everything was great and exciting and new. And then after a while, well, you start also experiencing the problems and the difficulties. Which is, I think, I mean, nothing here is not unnatural or so. I think it's just a way of life, right? After a while, the excitement goes away. You miss your friends, your family. And it's not different in teams. When you join a new team, whether it's a virtual team or a real team, it's exactly the same situation. Last but not least, I want to direct your attention to Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Which is also very essential because for global support, because we're dealing with people, and so much we're doing depends on people's ability to perform. And because of that, so much depends on the ability of our managers to take care of our people. And this is true across boundaries and across all countries we operate in. The most basic needs are food, water, breathing, air, and so forth, followed by safety. Now, safety also includes job security. So if you have people in your organization who are worried about your job, forget about belonging, esteem, and self-actualization, right? If I have to worry about losing my job because of something that corporate introduces here in my department, I cannot focus on this. So you have to make sure that you satisfy, first and foremost, the three basic layers. And then you can start working with people and ultimately achieve a level where they contribute, where they are being creative, where they participate, developing ideas, implementing solutions, and really work within the team and perform within the team. So I found that awareness and understanding of a little bit of psychology by all the managers is very helpful. And now, in which ways? And by the way, it's not always that it starts at the bottom and then works its way up. In many cases, the pyramid actually lies sideways, and you have to take care of a little bit of everything all the time. And you can translate this, right? A basic food could be pizza, chocolate, happy hour, followed by job security, followed by providing people a tribe and a sense of belonging and affiliation. Treat everyone with respect, even on email communication, even across the distances. And then provide people an opportunity to participate. If you do this, then, well, it's easier said than done, right? But if you address your people's needs, they will give back to you, and they will give back to us. And, of course, sometimes, I'm in violation of these common sense rules, right? And then I'm maybe not as respectful as I should be. And these are truths across countries. These are universal truths. And I would say, if I can conclude my presentation here, global support is nothing else than applied common sense. Thank you very much for your attention.